Welcome back to the CTO Playbook, the podcast dedicated to helping CTOs excel. In this episode, I'm speaking once again to Warren Beasley, this time about how CEOs can hire the right CTO and what best-in-class recruitment looks like in 2025. Warren last appeared in episode 3 of the CTO Playbook, still one of the most listened to episodes, talking about how to find a role as a CTO. And this time, we've turned the table around. Whether you're a founder preparing for your first tech leader or a growth stage CEO making a pivotal hire, this conversation is your playbook. Warren shares what separates successful CTO hires from the ones that quietly unravel, and the critical steps CEOs often overlook when defining the role, assessing fit, and closing the right candidate. If you're hiring a CTO this year or planning to be hired a CTO, this is an essential listen. Hello, I'm Adam Horner, your host. I coach CTOs across startups and enterprises, helping them escape the exhausting cycle of firefighting and build leadership skills anchored in confidence, clarity, and long-term purpose. I offer practical, bespoke coaching that's rooted in the real challenges CTOs face inside fast-moving organizations. I help tech leaders make the critical shift from reactive to strategic, empowering them to delegate with confidence, align engineering teams with broader business goals, and step fully into their role as trusted, influential executives. This podcast gives me the platform to share proven playbooks and insights with you and other leaders in tech who are committed to mastering their craft. Alongside brilliant guests, I'll be offering strategies, tools, and advice to help you shape a CTO playbook that's unique to your leadership journey. Warren, welcome back to the playbook. One of the most popular episodes we've ever had was episode 3, where you told us about the approach that a CTO needs to go through as they're finding a new role. And that's still one of the most popular episodes we've had on the download so far. So great to have you back as the first returning guest on the podcast. But before we go into your background, I'd love to just give it a quick check from you first. Because last time you spoke, you said it was the most difficult time in the industry in 30 years for recruiting CTOs. Has that changed?
Firstly, it's great to be back. As you know, Adam, I'm a very humble person. I haven't had anybody asking me for selfies or autographs, which I'm a little bit disappointed in.
I'm sure that'll come in time.
I'm sure. But the market has improved a little bit, not significantly. So I think we're going through quite an anomaly at the moment with the volume of really talented CTOs, senior tech leaders that are between jobs. And in my nearly 30 years, it's not something I've seen before. I think that's a reflection of where we are. I wish I could tell you why and when that's going to start changing. I'm seeing some positives, but rather like the turning circle of the QE2, it's not happening as quickly as I or a lot of the candidates I work with would like. Sadly.
Still a tough market, still going hard.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. And you mentioned there the 30 years you've been in industry. It'd be lovely for those people who are listening to you for the first time, just to get a bit of a background on who you are and how you came to your title of the CTO recruiter.
Certainly. So I'll try and keep this as succinct and within a minute as I can. Working in recruitment since the mid-90s. Prior to that, I worked in a whole host of different jobs, Lloyd's of London, Sal selling photocopiers. My first job after leaving school was actually in the street markets of London, quite close to a Silicon Roundabout, places like White Cross Street and Leather Lane. Progressed to, by chance, as most people who work in my industry, how it happens, chance meeting with an old family friend who had a friend that had this business in Bromley, which is in Kent on the borders with London. And they suggested that I should go along and have a chat with this guy that ran the business. And I didn't think too much of it. And then I decided I would get in touch. And it was really like a duck to water. I absolutely loved it from the first moment I walked in the door. But don't get me wrong. It was a baptism of fire back in those days. And I've used this analogy a lot. It was like, I imagine going into a Marco Pierre White or Gordon Ramsay kitchen, where everything was built on excellence. The candidates you were working with, if there was a punctuation error in a CV, and back in those days, we had a team of admin staff that were physically typing out CVs. If there was a comma that wasn't there, we would be hauled over. But you learned very quickly some very, very good practices. Fast forward from there, and my brother and I decided that, well, if we can do it for someone else, we could do it for ourselves. And at around the turn of the millennium, we started up working for ourselves. So we grew a team, grew a business. We had a couple of locations in Kent, Sussex, and London, primarily just technology. But we began to see that the levels of service that customers and clients were getting didn't really justify the fees that were being charged.
Right.
And there were lots of holes that we felt that we could try and fill. Essentially, we started to partner with clients far more.
Yeah.
We started to deliver a level of service that we felt justified that. And that progressed then, into moving up the hierarchy of technology roles where...
So the seniority hierarchy, then.
Absolutely. Where the natural progression was right up to CTO recruitment. One of the first things I say to a client and to a candidate when I first meet them is that I'm not hung up on job titles. It's all about outcome. And then they say, well, why have you got the CTO recruiter all over your branding? I said, well, it's a lot easier to have that than the outcome-based recruiter of tech leaders. I say that rather tongue-in-cheek, but yeah, that is my journey in as quick as I can. It wasn't under a minute, was it?
No, but it was pretty close.
Sorry about that.
Thank you. So years doing it and always going for the excellence and that sort of high level of service in terms of searching and locating the right person to have the impact needed in the business then.
Absolutely. Yeah, I come up with some terrible analogies, but recruiting well is a little bit like playing Texas Hold'em poker. It's a really easy game to learn and to execute. But if you want to be good at it, it's a very difficult industry to be consistently, and it's a people industry as well. So for some reason, it was like a duck to water, and I haven't look back, and I'm a big advocate for my industry as well. When it's done well, it is genuinely life-changing. Sadly, it's not always done well.
One of those things I'd love to have a chat with you about today, because talking about that water, that sea of CEOs who are looking for the next person to work for them and lead their technology, impacts that they need to have. Clearly, there are some who know what they want, and there are some who need some help getting towards the understanding what they need and who they need to bring into their business. And that's the bit I'd love to focus on today, Warren. So just talk us a little bit through who is your ideal customer from your point of view before we get onto some of the outliers as well.
No, sure. So if I was going to do some data analysis of the types of businesses that I've probably had most impact in my sweet spot would be from pre-seed to series C, investor-led businesses with a headcount from anywhere from 5 to 200.
Right.
However, I've recruited in the past, enterprise level FTSE 100 businesses as well. But where I tend to have my biggest impact is in that level of business. That tends to be where I have the most success.
Yeah. And it's an interesting space, isn't it? Because a lot of the times we think about, of course, the CEO is the leader of the business, so they're naturally going to be the one who's the customer. I've certainly seen a few scenarios where the CEO might be the customer on paper, but actually the client you're working for is actually the investor, the backer, the chairman of the board, or somebody else. So, of those, would you say that it's very often the CEO who's in the driving seat, or is it sometimes some of the other more interested parties, with stakes in the business that vary from financial holding all the way through to reputation?
I think probably the most successful CEOs that I've been lucky enough to work with have made themselves redundant when investments come into the business. They've realized where their strengths are and perhaps where their, I don't like using the word weaknesses, but I can't think of a better word to use, and they would shift themselves or pivot themselves to other roles within the business.
Right.
And I think that's a quality that I don't see as often as I would like with founders, particularly those where they've been involved in a bootstrap scenario, where there tends to be more ownership, personal ownership.
Yeah, when it's tied to that of the business, for example.
Yeah, and also that level of, that it's my baby, I can't let go of this, where that can be really destructive. But there's no one size fits all. And when you're dealing with people, it's very tricky. So, and it, you know, sometimes these big PE firms or VCs come into a startup or a scale up, they make changes, they enforce changes. And that can also have a massive negative impact, not only on the CEO, but also on the CTO, who was quite happy doing a really what they felt was a great rewarding role, only to be told overnight that the parameters have changed. The business is no longer going to be product-led. It's now going to be what we want to make sure we can bring in other businesses to. It's just a different model. So, yeah, it is a tough scenario to sort of pigeonhole too much. But that, I guess I try and focus my attention as much on that type of business at that type of level that has either gone through the investor-led piece,
yeah,
or is preparing for it with their eyes wide open.
Yeah. So I can imagine then almost all the time you're brought into a period of change by definition.
Mm.
And so how is it then that you sort of help them figure out, well, what is it that they're actually looking for? How do you help them express that and articulate it in a way that you then have a fairly certain mandate to go and search the right person for?
That's a really good question. So I would take a step back when I speak to a business that are interested in partnering with me. And there would be key things that they should be doing. And whether this be the CEO or the founder, whether they have their own talent acquisition team in place or HR team in place, for me, the first thing that any business should be doing or should know is within their niche sector, who the best in class, who the A-game players are. And so many businesses just don't know that.
Right.
So I want to ask them, you know, who do you recognize as being key players in your sector? And very rarely do I get answers back. I mean, sometimes they might feel, well, I'm not going to tell Warren because he's only going to go along and approach them. But genuinely, people don't know. And that's, for me, is a big red flag. Some of the most successful CEOs and founders I know will have, on a weekly basis, coffees with individuals that they may never hire, but they recognize them as being best in class key players in their industry. Now, perhaps that's more relevant, again, higher up that hierarchy within a business to the C-suite, to the CTO level. But I still think it applies at VP, at head of, or director of software level as well.
Yeah, just recognizing competitors and recognizing brilliance.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that, for me, is the first thing that I would say to an organization that they need to do, is to know who the key players are in their sector. The next thing, which is probably more role specific, but for me is absolutely key, and I've harped on about this on many pieces of content that I've shared in the past, which is, if you're going to hire somebody and you know the level of person you want to hire, would you expect the person to be employed already, or would you expect them to be between jobs? And the reason that's key is because it changes your approach. It changes the plan that you need in order to achieve your end goal. It may not seem that relevant at the outset, but because we're also going through an anomaly at the moment, if we were having this conversation 5 years ago, I wouldn't expect any business to say that they would consider somebody who's between jobs.
Right.
But if a business will consider somebody between the job, they have to put more emphasis on the inbound of looking for somebody rather than the outbound, which is traditionally where it had more success.
So it sort of affects how you go about looking for the next person then?
Yes, exactly that. And to understand from a client what their perception is. And then the next thing, which is equally as important, is, I guess this is more of a scenario situation, but I would say to a client, if somebody's working for the competition right now, delivering potentially an outcome that you need,
yeah,
can you state with conviction why that person should leave where they are now and join you? And the blank faces I sometimes get from somebody a CEO or a founder, when I ask them that question, it is quite surprising. But it's absolutely key, because if they can't convey why somebody should leave where they're working now to join them,
how will they convince a candidate?
Not only that, if they've got other people within the business, it has to be a message for me that comes from the top down, and it has to be pretty consistent, and it has to be warts and all. If there are particular challenges, they have to know that, because, you know, spoiler alert, most people who are delivering something now for a client actually don't move about the money. Yeah, okay, money's important. It does have an impact, but it's not all about the money. And equally, if we're looking at somebody that's between roles, you need to have that conviction and portray to them why it is that they should take your offer above anybody else's offers that they've got.
Yeah, because they've had a few at that stage.
You would think if they were of the caliber that you're looking for, if you are, as a business, you want best in class, then yeah, absolutely. You're not going to be the only person that's going to be approaching them, particularly if they're between roles. And then once you've got that, I guess these are the elements that are things that as a business you should know before you go to market with any role. Okay. So these aren't really that role specific, but they're more about, you know, the why, the elevator pitch of the business. But you'd be surprised how many, I mean, you get some very entrepreneurial founders and CEOs that will be able to tell you their version. Okay.
Yeah.
But it's not really something that you can convey to a technical leader, convince them enough to at least have a conversation with you. So it's about getting the right balance. They need to be able to do it. For me, it's really important that they can convey that.
And this is even before we get to the idea of what it is that they're actually looking for or what it is that they need solved.
Absolutely. If I'm running a business as a CEO or a founder, these are the key things. For me, and I'm a little bit biased, I'm not going to say ideas are to a penny, but, you know, potentially ideas are to a penny.
Yeah.
Unless you can get the talent in to deliver on it.
Yeah.
Of course, it's got to be timing. It's got to be market fit. It's got to be investment. But it's all about the talent. You'd expect me to say that, but I'm going to say it.
Yeah.
And those things that I've just mentioned have to be in place. You know, and everybody has to be singing from the same hymn sheet throughout the business. And then we move on to the role and creating a job spec. I'm not technical, Adam. You're going to be shocked at that. But I'm not technical, okay? If a client has specific technical essential skills that are needed or particular industry accreditations, that's non-negotiable. I can't question that. For me, a role needs to be conveyed in a way that a candidate can see themselves doing that themselves. And how I go about doing that with a client, and this is over and above a 2-3-4 page job spec,
yeah,
is I ask him this question, and I'm going to paraphrase slightly because I've worded this differently many ways depending on the organization.
Right.
But what I will say to a client is, I want you to imagine that you've already hired your new CTO and we're going to fast forward 12 months. And in that 12-month period, they've exceeded all expectations. They've hit it out the park. They've hit six sixes, however you want to phrase it. They've gone above and beyond. And you're walking into the boardroom to do your 12-month, your one-year review with them. What does that review look like? What have they done? What have they achieved? How have they moved things forward? And that is when I normally get from a blank look to a look of excitedness, of passion from a founder and a CEO. And they'll tell me things that are not in the job spec. And these are the things that I use as the basis of an advert, but more importantly, the basis of what I will use when I speak to somebody or pitch somebody for the first time.
So it's not necessarily something that goes into the job spec. It's not necessarily something that goes in paper, but it's something you use as a way to sort of litmus test people.
Pretty much. I mean, if we touch on the advert now, if a business is going to create an advert and all they're going to do is cut and paste the job spec, then don't waste your time. Okay. a advert is a story. It's a short novella. It's creating a visual that somebody can relate to. And that statement that I would get from a founder or from a CEO has enough in that for me to create something. Okay. Right. Now, the caveat with adverts is in 2025, if I was to advertise a CTO role today compared to 5 years ago, so 5 years ago, I get retained by a client, I advertise the position. We don't rely on adverts. We use it more branding.
Yeah.
We may get between 30 to 50 applicants over a month. Yeah. And we'll throw Pareto in there. So, you know, 80%, for whatever reason, just won't be right. But 20% would be certainly be worth having a further conversation with. Fast forward now, and that figure of 30 to 50 looks more like 1,000. Okay. Now, Pareto will still apply. So there'll be 200 people in that will come through applying for the job. And that's where I get really frustrated. It's not the right word to use, but knowing that in that 200 are some really, really talented people and they're not getting themselves in the right places to be found. And if we go back to who are the A players?
Yeah.
Who are the people? So during that, our previous podcast would have covered how you become known as being that type of person. So you put your head above the parapet without necessarily making people aware that you're actively looking for jobs.
Yeah.
You're just known as an industry expert. You're
just
known
increasing
as the,
your presence in the industry, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. So the two ways of approaching the search now then, one is relying on the 1,000 people that have applied to the job. But for me, the most thorough process is now mapping out your market. And this is something that all bona fide search firms will do. They will go through an exercise, either using good old traditional pen and paper or software, to go through every competitor, every type of business at a similar phase that has somebody doing the same role that your client needs, and coming up with a shortlist. Sometimes that can be hundreds, and then approaching them. So these are people that we would describe as passive.
Because they're not actively looking for a role right now, correct, but they do fit exactly what the business needs.
Correct. Yeah. I would argue perhaps that everybody's passive, because depending on their appetite for certain things.
Most people want an introduction at some point or other, aren't they?
Yeah. I mean, there are very, very few exceptions, should we say.
Yeah.
So, but it's people that aren't actively looking. It's for me, in historically, is where we want to be hunting, where we want to be focusing our attention. But we're in an anomaly.
Yeah.
Because of the volume of really talented people and tech leaders that are out there. So mapping your market, being proactive and going out, and then finding this short list of individuals, and then having that, should we say, 200 other people that have come in to the business. So potentially you could have between 300 to 500 names, if you do the job properly, of people that fit this criteria of a job role that you've got.
And that's way more than it used to be a few years ago,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely. It's crazy. It really is. But I guess the initial perception could be, well, that's great. That's your work done for you. You know, if you've got 200 people that have come in, there's other challenges now that enter the frame.
Filtering is one of them, I imagine.
Absolutely. Yeah. The screening of people, of candidates that are able to either do the job or can convey enough that they are able to do the job. And then proving that they can do the job as well.
Has that got any easier when you've got 200 to 300, or is that itself now harder, trickier process?
It is trickier. Experience definitely counts for a lot. So that you go through CVs, resumes, and you can tell reasonably quickly those individuals that are going to have the right type of background,
right,
for your client. And remember, our client's paying me to find them the bullseye. Okay. But when you're hiring yourself or you're a CTO out there, how do you make yourself be that target, be that bullseye? And again, we touched upon that in the previous podcast, but there are techniques that we use and that not enough businesses use that they should do. And my industry may be going, no, Warren, don't say anymore, don't say anymore. But I'm going to share some things with you that make the process more scientific, perhaps more thorough, but also speeds things along. Because one of the key criticisms I get, speed or the lack of it.
Yeah, companies moving too slowly,
yeah.
Missing out on candidates.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's a familiar experience, isn't it?
It is, and it happens a lot. And sometimes it can't be helped. So if you're a candidate, you should expect a structured interview process if you've got that far.
And the structure should be known pretty much when you get into it. I find a lot of the times frustration comes when you get into a process. You think, so what's happening next? Oh, I don't really know. So-and-so will talk to you and then we'll decide what happens next. That isn't a process. That's a wishful pipeline, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that we do, we call it the kickoff meeting with a client, which is about an hour and a half. And one of the things we discuss in detail is the interview process that everyone's agreed on, because we need to convey that to a candidate so they can expect, because there's a time investment. Only one candidate's going to get the CTO role, but there's going to be potentially 15, 20 other people that are going to invest some time. And they need to know how much time is going to be expected to invest in that. So that's really important to establish that process. There isn't a right or wrong, ideally, to try and keep the process down to no more than 3 interviews, in my experience. And if the first interview is able to be over video, all the better. But there are some things that we would look to introduce, and that, again, I think candidates, CTOs should be mindful of and be prepared for. And it's also about attitude. But when I speak to candidates about their thoughts on this, both when I'm hiring and also in some of the communities that we've got, what do they think about competency-based questions? And some of them will raise their eyebrows, even though I can't see them. I know they're raising their eyebrows at the thought of a competency-based question. But they're very powerful if they're the right ones.
And if it allows the right ones, indeed,
yeah,
yes.
Exactly that. And it allows a client to compare apples with apples.
Yep.
Now, we
get a baseline to compare everybody across, don't you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we'll go one step further and actually get a candidate to video the answers. But that isn't necessary. They can just be answered on a keyboard. But that is a great subject matter to discuss during the first interview, their answers to those questions. The advice I would give to candidates is, if you are declaring an outcome on your CV, whether that be a digital transformation, whether that be a massive improvement in downtime, whether that be the ARR that your product, SaaS product, has generated within 12, the devil's in the detail. During that interview process, that smacks of, I'm not going to say the L word, but it smacks of perhaps not being as accurate as you're portraying it. You need to be ready to give detail when you're asked the questions, particularly with CV review. One of the techniques that I used to use when I used to actually meet people in person and shake their hands, good old pre-COVID days, I'd have their CV in front of me, and I would go through their CV in reverse chronological order. I want to establish how they found out about every role that they got. Now, if you're a CTO that's been working in the industry for 20 plus years, you should have examples of where you found your job through your network, where a previous colleague or a previous boss approached you for a coffee and said, look, I want to have a chat with you about something, or something that we did in our previous role. I've got something that, not through an advert, not through a recruiter. That's a very powerful thing to have achieved. Most people I speak to have done it. Nobody ever mentions it in their CV.
And why do you think that is? I mean, do you think people like us CTOs and aspirant CTOs kind of downplay the importance of being able to show that we have a network and demonstrating in that way? Or do you think it's just considered that these days most people find their jobs through being poached, recruited, or applying online for roles?
I think there's a mixture of both. But where you can definitively say that you've been effectively headhunted, where someone has approached you, I think that's a really powerful, big green flag.
Yeah.
If conversely, if someone's watching this and they go, well, I've only ever got my job through applying for adverts, it's not a red flag and it may never be brought up. But if you're being interviewed by somebody that's worth their salt, they will recognize it. Why have you never followed a pattern of being approached by previous bosses? That's the biggest testimony you can get if someone comes back to you. So anyway, that's just a short thing on the CV.
It's about filtering, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. Yeah. But this is when you've actually got somebody either in front of you or whether you have somebody who's over video. So
it does kind of reinforce that it isn't just about skills and background. It is something that, because I've noticed this as well, that network, temperament, how you approach work, who you know, how well you work with people is all often more than, if not as significant as the, you know, the technical background, solutions you've solved, the results that you've delivered in organizations. It's also about how you go about it and what tools you have at your disposal, isn't it?
Absolutely. Again, I'm very humble. I'm not somebody that likes to, you know, blow my own trumpet, Adam, but our retention rates for new hires are just over 96% within the first 12 months. If you're going to push me for 2 years, it's just over 93%.
And it's an extraordinary statistic, that is. I don't think that's blowing your own trumpet. I think that's almost unique.
There is a key reason, I believe, behind that. And it's to do with the levels that a business goes through when they decide on selecting somebody. So typically, people are selected and decided that they're the right hire on two levels. And that the first level is how they appear, how they look, how they come over, whether it be how their CV or resume is presented, whether it be their social media. And the second thing is what they can do and what they've done. Now, that's really broad what I've just said, but it describes their career from their academic through all of the, you know, all of the languages that they've learned, the stuff that they've built and scaled and exited. Typically in the first year to 18 months, neither of those reasons is why hires don't work out. What I tend to hear from clients will be something like, we were really looking forward to them coming in as our new CTO, but they just didn't fit, or they just didn't get the culture, or the CTO and the CFO really clashed. Okay. And these aren't things that you can typically prepare for. Well, actually, you can.
You can test for that, can't you? Because I've seen several scenarios where you see a CEO and a CTO clashing and having a real challenge in the role. And you think a couple of well-placed questions during the process probably could have at least shown this as a red flag to look at and differentiate between candidates.
You're absolutely spot on. And there is science out there that does that. We work with an organization called McQuaid, who are one of the recognized leaders. And they have this product that we use called a job survey. It's a 10 to 15 minute Q&A that every stakeholder in a business will answer separately. And what it does, it extracts the behavioral qualities, what that individual expects this person to behave, extra level are based around how a person conducts themselves. And then, and I would normally only do this when you get a shortlist of between 2 to 4 candidates that have been through a couple of interviews, I would then ask them to complete their behavioral assessment and compare. And there's an aggregate. So for example, if 3 stakeholders within the business complete a job survey, it will come up with one survey, which is an infographic, which will tell you the type of personality match that they feel will be right both for the role and for where the business is right then in terms of a culture fit.
Right.
I've never had an exact match, ever. But what you get is approximate matches, but you get discussion points.
Yeah. I mean, arguably, you wouldn't want an exact match because you don't want to create a homogenous leadership team. You want a bit of variety and difference of approach and opinion in there.
Absolutely. And if you were going to say to me, Warren, why is it you're able to achieve these levels of retention? It's because of that. That's the key thing. Once you do the basics, which is knowing that value proposition, that why you're searching correctly, you're finding the right people, people have got the right skills, the right background. It's that extra level. I think candidates have to be more so now prepared to go through that process. It's a 15-minute, 20-minute survey that they have to complete, and they'll get to keep. But it's another time commitment.
Yeah.
But it's a very powerful, scientific, and proven element, but not enough businesses use it.
And as a candidate, if you're asked to go through one of those, you should be welcoming it. And if you get through that and you're offered the role, you can be fairly sure of having a comfortable time in the job with a good fit.
Well, it's a two-way thing.
Yeah.
Because what you get is a report that will actually pinpoint the types of interview questions that you should be asking, depending on how somebody matches up with the ideal scenario, the ideal person, and vice versa. And it allows a candidate to be really precise and not just rely on gut, because gut can be great, but it isn't always the best.
Well, gut relies on experience, doesn't it? And experience comes from having changed jobs a lot of times. And a lot of people don't actually go through C2 interviews that often.
No, they don't. You're quite right. So it's a very powerful thing as well. That's one of the, I think, the biggest differentiators that we use. To be fair, most of the CTOs that go through that process really welcome it, as you just mentioned, alluded to. Yeah. And they use that for other job searches as well. They'll use the information that they've extracted on themselves and stuff to either not change themselves, but be mindful of how they perhaps come across, or perhaps areas that they may want to focus on more for improvement. So yeah, it's
fantastic, a bit of a tool to have a knock-on impact, just from bringing recruiting the CTO, also impacting other roles in the vicinity in the area around that role as well.
Absolutely. And when the CTO gets hired, and we've seen this many times, they get to choose how they're going to recruit their VP of engineering or head of product. Virtually always ask us if we can introduce the job survey as well for the other roles that report into them. So it's an interesting one. And then, of course, after that, once the board meeting have decided who they want to go for, there's the offer. Now, there's nothing worse as a candidate in having no news. And one of the things that I absolutely drum into my clients is that even if you don't have any news, if there are things out of your control, we must be able to share the fact that there's no news. Okay, so there's a delay at that time is absolutely critical. But if, as a candidate, if you're wanted by a client, they should be able to let you know. You should have a phone call from them to tell you that. You may be asked what your thoughts are on the position as well. And you should be, within 24 hours, presented with a written job offer that would typically have a three-day time lapse.
So it's a fairly quick turnaround and then a fairly short decision time on the back of that as well.
Typically, yeah.
What's the logic behind the three-day decision window?
I think from a client's perspective, if somebody wants the role, then normally within 24 hours, they would accept it.
Yeah.
If a candidate doesn't want the role and 2 days passes, it's normally because they're waiting on something else.
Right.
That they think is better.
Not the first choice.
Then you won't, either you're not the client's first choice. No, sorry, you're not the exactly. You're not the candidate's first choice.
Yeah.
And that's not a bad thing. It's a good thing to be in demand. But clients now are adopting that necessity to want to know, because let's say, for example, we got this shortlist down to 3 people. They've all completed the job survey and they've all done well, but you are the standout candidate. But the other 2 candidates would be able to do the job. But you're the standout. But the other 2 have got job offers, or the other 2 are doing maybe what this candidate's doing, which is, I'm not sure. The client needs to know within at least 2 or 3 days if they're going to take it. Because if they are, great. If they're not, then they don't lose out on the other 2 and then go back to the drawing board. That's the logic behind it.
Yeah.
Frustrating. And sometimes if a recruiter doesn't handle it with delicacy and professionalism, it can come across as being a little bit pushy.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, my philosophy is always that it's going to be a win-win for both sides. And I definitely would not want a candidate joining a position because they felt pressurized by either a client or by a recruiter, because that's a no-no.
Yeah.
That's a big no-no.
And when it comes to handling negotiations around the offer, because the offer is often, it's literally that, it's an offer, it's a first pass. Is there anything special you do around that? Because I've heard lots of different techniques and approaches that hiring organizations take to setting, especially executive, you know, remuneration and positions, is often quite specialized and quite unique, often down to the candidate. Are there any sort of rules of thumb or general approaches you have on that?
For me personally, I will always try to establish expectation from a candidate earlier in the process.
Right.
Okay. Because what I don't want to do, if we're speaking to a candidate who's expecting a basic that's going to start with a two, but all that my client's going to be able to offer them is a basic that starts with a one, but they're going to give them, you know, a slice of the action, or a piece of the action, that isn't going to wash. So first thing is to set out some level of expectation. But for me, it's about being very clear that I work for both parties.
Yeah.
I represent both parties, and just be as to be transparent. Sometimes I can't be transparent because I'm not being given the information. But I want two entities, two essentially at the end of the day, it's people. I want these people, the client, to feel that they've got really great value. And I want this person to feel as though they've got great value as well. I would say probably most of the time, the first or second offer tends to do it. There's not that much, but the hard work is done before that with expectations.
Setting up beforehand. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. So that the actual offer and the acceptance of an offer isn't coming as a big surprise. It's all the way down that, if you like, that corridor, that journey is making sure the client's aware what the candidate's looking for, the candidate's aware what's potentially in the budget, what's available.
Yeah.
So when it gets to that final stage, and as long as everybody's got their cards on the table and there's transparency,
it should be in the ballpark.
Yeah. Absolutely. Excellent.
When it comes to the stage after that, Warren, is there any, because, you know, there's the whole section of onboarding, there's the, you know, the first 3 months delivery. Yeah. And typically recruiters don't get involved in that stage or have much influence after the ink is on the signature. Is there any influence that you have at that stage? Is there advice that you give to CEOs and recruiters to try and make sure that 1 year and hopefully your 2 year statistic is maintained?
Yes, there is. It is a really simplistic thing that I leave with every client. They don't always use it. And it's what we call the confidential questionnaire. And that sounds really simplistic, but it's making sure that a candidate can communicate confidently from day one with either their line manager or anonymously how they're feeling, what is bothering them, particularly in the first 3 months. And the amount of businesses that just, right, we've got them now. They're over there doing the job. They've taken out the team for lunch. So we're just leaving to get on with it. No, I encourage them, particularly in the first months, to have regular, you know, tell me what you think. And then for CTO to carry that on with their team as they hire it. And that's when you see staff retention figures for the whole business take off. It's these little things, and it's a really simplistic process, but it's often missed by organizations. Now, there's other stuff
that
we do.
It's basically a key open feedback channel, isn't it? Yes. If to simplify it down to ridiculous.
100%, that is exactly what it is to encourage that. Whatever format they want to use, confidential questionnaire, I don't know, carrier pigeon, however they want to do it, there has to be recognized non-guilt trip platform. That, and we're not talking about, I don't like the view I've got out of my window. And we're not going on to, at that level, although that can be important, but we're talking about stuff that's important to somebody for them to feel confident in sharing that. And for me, that doesn't get done enough. And other things that we do, well, as soon as we're the hire's right, we would normally go and take the CTO and the tech founder and CEO out for lunch and hope that they've enjoyed the process and the experience and it's been streamlined. But these are all things that a founder and a CEO can do themselves.
It isn't rocket science at the end of the day. So
it's not.
Tell me, Warren, have you ever had situations where you've done it all right? You've let's just quickly run through it. They know the market, who they're looking for. They've created a great job spec that, you know, conveys what the candidate can see themselves in,
yep,
in the job ad. They've mapped out their market. They've gone through that screening and filtering, including a behavioral test to make sure there's compatibility, yep, gone through a great offer process. They've got a good feedback channel in that first few months, and then it's still fallen apart.
Typically
does it tend to be the cause of that? If there's a typical, I mean, you know, with 97%, we're talking about the exceptions here rather than the rules. So, but
what happens, not all the time, particularly when you're dealing with passive candidates, sometimes they will be approachable to your outreach because they're not happy. And a lot of the time it's because they're not happy with money. So they will use the process to gain leverage. And when they resign and they get the counter, they will accept it.
Right. Okay.
Now that's when the whole process has gone from start to finish, where you've been given verbal, to be honest with you, at the outset, when we speak to candidates, we will give them that scenario, particularly if they're, you know, best in class. Look, we're going to put you forward to our client. I just need to ask you that, you know, if you're going to consider this role, is there a reason behind it? Why? What is it that you want to see improved? And if they tell you, I don't think I would criticize a recruiter to say to the candidate, well, look, can you try and address that to see whether or not you can get any movement on it? And if you can, well, great, well done. But if you can't, come back to us and then we'll go through the process again. I've seen that happen. Okay.
So try and reduce that idea that people are just using it for leverage, not for anything else. Yeah.
But that tends to be the biggest reason behind, where you think that you've done everything correctly. You represented the client and you represented the candidate to the best of your ability. And it should just be, there's never a formality, but it should be as near as damn it. That tends to be the reason behind it. And sadly, and again, I feel like I'm echoing myself, there's always exceptions.
Yeah.
But sadly, I don't often see the counter offer presenting longevity. They tend to find themselves...
Money's one aspect of their unhappiness, but not all of it, isn't it?
Well, they're also considered as the person that twisted our arm to get more money and we couldn't afford them to go. And when we do get the bonuses come out, are we going to give this person... They've already shown us where their commitment levels are because they've been out interviewing elsewhere, but we had to keep them because they, you know, there's a house of cards that's going to fall down if you get my drift.
So it does tend to be a short-term thing, the counteroffer. I've seen that time and again, actually.
Sorry?
I've seen that time and again where, you know, inside a company, you see a counteroffer being made and there's often immediate suspicion. Oh, it's okay for this time, but what's going to happen next time?
And I think there are definitely exceptions. I know a couple of people that have gone, look, I'm sorry, I've been into... One was with the NHS, funnily enough, and it was a tech startup, a health tech startup, and the guy's manager took him out for dinner to wish him good luck, and during that dinner, persuaded him to stay. This was after an 8-week hiring process.
Wow.
Manager. So it happens. Yeah. But the guy's still there. We're still in touch. There was never burned bridges. Absolutely not. Either side of the divide. Never, ever burned bridges. So it does sometimes pay off, but very rarely. And I can't really think of any other scenario. Sometimes there's personal circumstances where, say, for example, we have somebody that's working here from South Africa and they have to go home for family reasons. Or I'm saying that because that has happened to me in the past. I haven't had anybody win the lottery yet and decide that they want to give up work and have declined it.
I think my CTOs would probably carry on working if they won the lottery.
I think virtually every CTO I know would carry on working if they won the lottery. Yeah, you're quite right. You're quite right.
Excellent.
So yeah, that's pretty much the scenarios that where I've had to cry into my cup of tea for a couple of hours and then get back on the saddle again.
So in terms of what our CTOs listening to this can take away from this, in terms of a good structured process, at least now they know what a good process should look like and do expect to do those personality surveys because they do actually serve a purpose. I know quite a few people who've been frustrated with my, even though one person who refused to take a role because he was asked to fill in a personality survey and didn't really understand the point behind it. I think you make a very good case that it really ensures the fit long term, so that you know you're going to have a good compatibility with the team that you're joining.
I know a lot of tech professionals that will refuse to do a coding test because they've been doing a particular syntax of code for the last 15 years. But unfortunately, businesses need some element of screening that they can use and fall back on when they're selecting. I know it's a pain, but I do, and I know it's time consuming, particularly if you don't get the gig, if you don't get the role. And I absolutely do get that genuinely, but it sadly it's part of the of that process. And I do hope that people can see the other side.
Yeah, I think it's especially relevant at this time in the market when there's so many people for every role that comes up.
Yeah.
Getting yourself to stand apart by making sure that you are a good fit for the role that you do go for and end up securing, surely that should be a good thing. So, I mean, I've always been in favor of these things, but then I have been on the recruiting side as well. So I've seen the value of it from the executive suite side, as well as from the CTO side. I'm in that strange situation where I'm a CTO who has hired CTOs in the past, normally to replace myself.
Yes. And but, I think most CTOs, exactly as you say, can see the benefit because they've been through the process.
Yeah.
But occasionally they don't, but there you go. That's human nature, isn't it?
Warren, as always, I'd love you to leave our listeners, our CTOs, with one tip in the current market. What do you say is the one thing that's allowing the CTOs that you're positioning in companies right now to stand apart?
Well, the key thing for me at the moment is don't stand still. And what I mean don't stand still is continue to be exploring. Don't hide yourself away. Once you find all this great momentum that you built up, if you've created this brand that people use, a reliable source of knowledge or motivation, once you start a role, don't stop it. One of the biggest benefits a company gets when they hire you is not only are you a great CTO, but you're recognized in your industry as a great CTO. So don't switch that off. Keep that going.
Keep publicizing it yourself.
Absolutely.
There you go. You heard it from the CTO recruiter himself first. Warren, it's been wonderful to speak to you again. Thank you very much.
I've enjoyed it. I'm now going to finish off my Diet Coke because my voice is going. And Adam, great to see you again.
Thanks. Talk soon.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much for listening all the way through to the end. Just before you go, I'd like to ask you for one thing in return for putting together all these episodes of the CTO Playbook podcast for you. Please leave a review. Wherever you're listening, whether that is Apple Podcasts or Spotify or whichever platform you're on, leaving a quick review will help more CTOs find the podcast and enable me to create more great episodes. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you on the next episode of the CTO Playbook.